little kids. We're glad that we can team up with these parents in nurturing these precious gifts of the children along their spiritual journey, in their spiritual journey. And we look forward to the way in which these kids will someday make an impact in the church. And we're just glad. We're just glad that we can celebrate days like this. Good morning again, everyone. Again, my name is George. I'm one of the pastors here on staff, and I'd invite you to take your worship folder to hand, maybe grab a pen and make some notes from things that you find helpful from today's message. Inside your worship folder, there's also a reflection guide, some questions that you can ask yourself as you deal with what we're talking about this morning a little bit further this coming week. We're in the back end of our series, Upon Further Review, where much like in football, hockey, and baseball, plays that are challenged and are closely reviewed by officials, we're putting under review critical areas of our life. And so far in this series, we've looked at our relationships to time, to money, to work, to our values, to marriage, to parenting. And last week, we talked about worry. This morning, we're going to look at what is likely one of the most overlooked areas of our lives, an area of our life some of us may even take for granted, and that is our friendships, our relationship to our friends. Let me ask you this, by show of hands, how many of you remember your very first best friend? Just put your hands up. You remember your very first best friend, right? I think for many of us, that's a very prominent memory. As I reflected on my life, my very first best friend was my next door neighbor, Jeff. Jeff's parents and my parents built homes next door to each other in a new subdivision within a relatively short period of time. We moved into our new house next to Jeff's family when I was about 4 years old, so like 20 years ago or something like that. And Jeff and I were like best friends, like right up until the end of junior high, at the beginning of senior high, when his parents very sadly split up and they sold the house and moved away. But from the age of four until we were about 14 years old, we were largely inseparable. We rode bikes together. We went skateboarding together. We played road hockey and ice hockey together, baseball and a bunch of other sports. His family had a swimming pool, so during the hot summer days, we spent a lot of time in the pool. We went to elementary and junior high school together. We played on teams together. We got chased by girls together. Hey, we were adorable. What can I say? As I got older, particularly during high school and then university, there are some other names that came to my mind as I reflected on my journey in terms of who my close friends were. There was Stephen and Doug. There was Kevin and Gordy. There's James and Bruno. There's Danny and Gerald. You could probably do the same thing. Go through your mind, that catalog of memories, and list the names of good friends you've had over the course of your life. Now, some of us are wired to have lots of friends all of the time. It doesn't matter where we go. Some of us have the uncanny ability to strike up strong relationships along the way. Others of us, we're not wired like that. We're more introverted and aren't prone to easily making friends. We prefer fewer but deeper friendships. And some of you can relate to what I'm talking about. Whatever the case, the thing that is often overlooked is how important and impactful the relationships that we have in our lives are, particularly with our closest friends. There's a reason why parents, particularly those who are good parents, pay very close attention to who their children's friends are. Because we know how impactful and influential friends can be in the lives of our children. Think back for a minute with me on your own life, to a time you allowed your friends to influence you negatively and things went really, really badly for you. Do you remember that? Contrarily, there are other instances in your life where you remember how a friend spoke truth into your life and influenced you in a positive direction. And looking back now, you're thinking, thank God for that friend. If I didn't have that friend, who knows where I would be right now? The bottom line is, for good or bad, our friends tend to have a high level of influence in our life. And this truth is largely summed up in some wisdom King Solomon handed down to us. King Solomon was known as one of the wisest men who ever lived. And it's there on the screen. It's Proverbs 13, verse 20. And I'll be reading it out of the English Standard Version. How about we all read this together? Read this with me, nice and loud. Whoever walks with the wise becomes wise, but the companion of fools will suffer harm. That last phrase there, the companion of fools will suffer harm, sums up high school for some of you, doesn't it? If you're in high school right now, pay attention. This is really important. I'm not sure what your high school experience was like, but when I went to an inner city school in southern Ontario with some 2,300 students. And looking back, I remember there being groups of kids that I think behaved like a company of fools. They certainly didn't propel one another on to love and good deeds, if you know what I mean. I remember in my grade 11th year, the kid across the hall from me was expelled from school for storing illegal weapons in his locker. He was part of a company of fools. For good or bad, our friends tend to have a huge influence in our lives, don't they? Now, if you view your life as a dining room table, like we've got set up here, the friends in your life are the ones that you have invited to sit at your table. Your friends are the ones who have a seat and speak into your life. Your friends are the ones who you've chosen to give a voice in your life, to influence your decision-making. And by the way, this never can be about placing blame. We can't say that the poor decision was this friend's fault or this other friend's fault. No, my poor decision was my fault. Your poor decision was your fault. We each have to take responsibility for our own decisions. That said, we also have to acknowledge that our friends do play a very big role in the decisions that we make. And some of us have suffered a lot of harm because we took bad advice from people we thought were our friends. Part of the responsibility we have in our life is that we get to choose who has a seat at our table. You get to choose who has a voice. So let me ask you this. Who has a seat at your table? With that in mind, some of us might have to admit today, as we put our friendships under review, that maybe we've become a companion of fools along the way. We're not walking with the wise. Maybe we're actually walking with very unwise people right now. Let me give you a powerful example of this from the Bible, and then we'll take a closer look at our own lives. In 1 Kings chapter 12, we read an incredible story. This passage paints this really interesting picture for us, where King Solomon, who was known to be the wisest and wealthiest man who ever lived, the son of King David, about how he brought Israel to a place of prominence and prestige by making Israel the economic center of the then known world, largely through massive construction projects. He built a magnificent palace for himself that took 13 years to construct. He built an awe-inspiring, ornate temple for God that took 7 years to build. And along with these huge undertakings, he built an infrastructure that supported all of those projects. He built aqueducts. He had forest preserves. He built a fleet of ships for international trade. A bunch of stuff that propelled the economy of his kingdom into high gear. And he accomplished all of this by largely forcing the labor of his own people. He made it happen on the backs of his own people. And as a consequence, at the end of Solomon's reign, when he died, the people were really, really tired. So when Solomon's son Rehoboam assumed the throne, the people of Israel who had worked so hard for Solomon sent some delegates, some representatives to Rehoboam, making a simple request. So we'll pick up the story in verse 4 of 1 Kings chapter 12. Here's what the delegates said. Your father put a heavy yoke on us, but now lighten the harsh labor and the heavy yoke he put on us, and we will serve you. That seems like a pretty reasonable request, doesn't it? Your father worked us really, really hard. He wore us out, and quite frankly, we're exhausted. What we need is a break. We'll sign up to serve you. We will follow you. What we need is some rest. Look at how Rehoboam answers. Rehoboam answered, go away for 3 days and then come back to me. And so the people went away. Then King Rehoboam consulted the elders who had served his father Solomon during his lifetime. How would you advise me to answer these people? He asked. Now, this looks like a great course of action, doesn't it? Don't just react without thinking. Take some time to mull things over. Send the delegates away. Ask them to come back in 3 days. give this whole matter some serious consideration for a few days. And then on top of that, he seeks the counsel of the elders who had served his father Solomon. These guys had wisdom. They'd been around the block before. And so this is a pretty smart move on Rehoboam's part. But here's something we need to remember. Age doesn't necessarily equal wisdom, right? They're not necessarily traveling companions. I know men in particular, they tend to age one of two ways. We age like wine or we age like milk, right? Isn't it really one or the other? There's really no in between. We either get better or we get worse. It's one of those two things. So being old doesn't necessarily mean being wise, though there's a good chance that you're going to find wisdom amongst the aged. And so Rehoboam turns to those who have experience and understanding, to those who worked with King Solomon, and he was the wisest man, so you think some of his wisdom would have rubbed off on them. So Rehoboam consults with them, looks to them for counsel, and here's what they say. They replied, verse 7, "If today you will be a servant to these people and serve them and give them a favorable answer, they will always be your servants." This is great advice. I mean, you don't need to be a rocket scientist to figure this out. They want rest. Give them rest. View yourself as their servant, not the other way around. Take care of them, and then they'll ultimately take care of you. Don't you kind of wish our politicians today would adopt that posture? They forget that they exist because we do. They're there actually to serve us. Anyways, they say, serve them, take care of them, and then they'll take care of you, be loyal to you, and they will follow you. So far, so good. Rehoboam is taking time to think things through. He's seeking wise counsel. He's tapping into the wisdom of the elders. But look at the next verse. But Rehoboam rejected the advice the elders gave him and consulted the young men who had grown up with him and were serving him. Ultimately, Rehoboam didn't like what he was hearing from the men who had advised his father. He wanted to hear something different. He didn't want to be a servant. He wanted the people to serve him. He wanted to be the king. He wanted to be the one who exercised power. He wanted to be the man. And what he actually really wanted was some yes men who would simply tell him what he wanted to hear. So instead of listening to the advice of these older wise men, he goes to his buddies who he had grown up with to get advice from them. And the way I picture this is that Rehoboam makes his way over to the Theta Beta Delta fraternity house, wakes his buddies up from a drunken stupor amidst empty pizza boxes and beer bottles, gets the Xbox turned off for a second, and he says, "Hey guys, could you give me some advice on the first and most important decision I'm going to make as king?" Seems like a brilliant move on his part, doesn't it? Verse 9, he asked them, "What is your advice? How should we answer these people who say to me, 'Lighten the yoke your father put on us'? What should I do, but guys? You're my friends, you're my buddies, you want good for me, right? What's my next move?" The young men who had grown up with him replied, verse 10, "These people have said to you, 'Your father put a heavy yoke on us, but make our yoke lighter.' Now tell them, 'My little finger is thicker than my father's waist. My father laid on you a heavy yoke. I will make it even heavier. My father scourged you with whips. I will scourge you with scorpions.'" Do you get a sense of how moronic, unintelligent, and unwise this advice is? I mean, this is terrible counsel. And when they say to him, "Tell the people, my little finger is thicker than my father's waist," the original Hebrew word here in the text is the word for loins. So I'll edit this a little bit, but it means the center of a man's masculinity. You following me? If you don't, I can't help you. I'm sorry. Right? Do you see how brash this is? How unintelligent, how stupid their advice is? So instead of telling Rehoboam to serve the people like the wise advisors told him, these guys are telling their friend basically to strut about like some cocky rooster, flexing his muscle, trying to intimidate the people, showing them who's boss. And so the son of the man who wrote the very words, "Whoever walks with the wise becomes wise, but the companion of fools suffers harm," he does this. Verse 12. 3 days later, Jeroboam And all the people returned to Rehoboam, as the king had said, come back to me in 3 days. The king answered the people harshly. Rejecting the advice given him by the elders, he followed the advice of the young men and said, my father made your yoke heavy. I will make it even heavier. My father scourged you with whips. I will scourge you with scorpions. Anyone want to guess how this all turned out for Rehoboam? That's right. Not well. Not well at all. Shortly after this, the people revolted, causing a civil war. The kingdom was ultimately divided into a northern and southern kingdom with different kings in each region. And Rehoboam went on to set a precedent of what would become a long list of horrible, terrible leaders in Israel for generations to come. Now, there is something that we need to note here, something really worth taking note of. Rehoboam was not some young punk who hadn't seen much of life when all this went down. He was 41 years old when he assumed the throne. Age does not necessarily make someone wise. Rehoboam ultimately invited a bunch of yes men to his table, and he didn't receive wise counsel from them. It was Rehoboam's father, Solomon, who also wrote this, Proverbs 26, verse 6. Wounds from a friend can be trusted, but an enemy multiplies kisses. Let's read that together. This is powerful. Wounds from a friend can be trusted, but an enemy multiplies kisses. Here's the thing. You surround yourself with yes men, they're actually your enemy. Yes men are actually your enemy. So let me give you a diagnostic tool as we turn from Scripture to our lives that may help you in terms of your friendships. And it revolves around this one question right here. Do you have friends who speak truth into your life? Do you have friends? It's going to come up on the screen right away. Do you have friends who speak truth into your life? I want you to think back over this past year. Go back over 2017 in your mind. At any point this last year, can you think of a moment where a friend came to you and said something to you that you did not want to hear? Do you think of a moment? They spoke some truth into your life that stung a little bit. They made you aware of some things in your journey, your behavior, or asked you some questions that made you feel a little bit uncomfortable. Do you recall a moment like that when a friend served you in that way? If yes, you have good friends. If no, there are some possibilities here, and I'll mention three. Number one, you don't have any real friends. You've surrounded yourself with yes men. Or number two, you haven't invited your real friends to speak truth into your life. And here's the deal with real friends. Because they want good for you, they will ask you tough questions. And because they're good friends, they don't ever look forward to confronting you with stuff. Good friends don't do that. They're not like that. They don't look forward to speaking truth into your life. They're willing because they care about you and they want what's best for you. But what good friends often need is for you to invite them to speak truth into your life. They need for you to say, listen, I need you to ask me the tough questions. Some of your best friends are waiting for an invitation to do that. Maybe you haven't done that yet. Or thirdly, there's a third possibility, is that you have friends, but they're just not wise friends. This is a distinct possibility. You have friends, but they're not wise. Wise in terms of how the Bible defines wise. So think about that for a second. Wounds from a friend can be trusted, but an enemy multiplies kisses. It's going to hurt. You may not want to hear it, but if it comes from a true friend, you can trust it. Why? With a true friend, you can trust their intentions towards you. The question then becomes, how do you know that you can actually trust someone? And that's a great question. The tough part is, you learn to trust someone by doing what? By trusting them. And you learn to do that over time. Over time, you discern if they truly want good for you. And you do that by trusting them with a little. This is the way Jesus would say it. And if they prove faithful with a little, then you give them some more until you learn that you can trust them with a lot. We have to trust people with a little to see if they can be trusted with a lot. And that's really hard for many of us, isn't it? Like I mentioned earlier, some of you, you're very quick to make friends with people. It's not difficult for you at all. You're able to be transparent and inviting. People gravitate to you and you to others. And it doesn't take much for you to trust someone and build a relationship, build a friendship with them. But most of us, we're not wired that way. It's not the way we interact. Most of us are a little bit more guarded. We hold back. Because when you trust someone like that, you're giving them an opportunity to hurt you. And that's called being vulnerable. And that isn't easy for most of us. We might like it when others are vulnerable with us, but if we're honest, we don't like being vulnerable. I meet people like this all the time, by the way. They're so happy to ask me 1,000 different questions, inviting me to be vulnerable. But when I start asking them questions, they're locked up tighter than a vault. It's like, don't go there with me. It becomes a bit of a disingenuous relationship, doesn't it, when only one person shares? Kind of feels like someone's just wanting information on you, right? That's not a friendship. That person's not being a good friend. But here's the question. Are you being vulnerable with others? Do you have close friends with whom you can be vulnerable? The word vulnerable comes from the Latin word vulnerare. Vulnerare. And it means capable of being wounded, open to risk, or damage. Being vulnerable means you're open to getting hurt. And for some of us, we've got a lot of good reasons not to be vulnerable, don't we? We've got a bunch of reasons why we should be guarded, because we can point to specific people in our past that we thought we could trust, or people we actually did trust, and what did they do? They hurt us. And some of them hurt us badly. They didn't deliver the kind of wounds that come from a friend. They delivered the kind of wounds that come from an enemy. And we got hurt. We got wounded. And we made a vow. We said, never again will that happen to me. I will not trust like that again. I'm not going to be vulnerable again. I'm not getting hurt. And so we close ourselves off and we protect our heart. And you know what? That makes a lot of sense. The problem, though, with that posture is that it comes with a lot of unintended consequences. And those consequences are something C.S. Lewis describes in his book, The Four Loves. He said it this way, follow along on the screen. To love at all is to be vulnerable. Love anything and your heart will be wrung and possibly broken. If you want to make sure of keeping it intact, you must give it to no one, not even an animal. Wrap it carefully around with hobbies and little luxuries. Avoid all entanglements. Lock it up safe in the casket or coffin of your selfishness. But in that casket, safe, dark, motionless, airless, it will change. It will not be broken. It will become unbreakable, impenetrable, irredeemable. To love is to be vulnerable. This is what this means. Real friendship entails real risk. Real friendship entails real risk. There's no skating past this. Being vulnerable is risky. Building relationships is risky. You open up, you risk getting hurt. People being what they are, people, sinners, some redeemed, some not, they make mistakes and they're capable of causing pain in others. But the alternative to being vulnerable is living a cold, lonely life, one where we live under the illusion that we can be perfect and bulletproof. And Brené Brown says it this way, perfect and bulletproof are seductive, but they don't exist in the human experience. Okay. It's alluring to pursue that, to pursue perfect, to pursue bulletproof. The problem is you're chasing a unicorn that simply doesn't exist. The primary reason we avoid being vulnerable with others is this deep desire for safety. The reason we don't risk is that we want to be safe. And wanting to be safe is a good thing. But whenever we make a good thing, an ultimate thing, this is what idolatry is ultimately all about, ultimately that good thing becomes a bad thing, a destructive thing in our life. The same thing is true with safety. We want to make safety an ultimate thing in life. And if you do, you end up doing things in your relationships that are very destructive. And so the reason I don't become vulnerable with you, the reason I don't risk opening up to you, I don't share my life with you, is because I'm afraid. I'm afraid you might hurt me by taking what I share with you and using it as a weapon against me. And so we want to be safe because we're afraid. But in trying to be safe, we isolate ourselves. And isolation, by definition, is unsafe. Any of you enjoy watching nature shows on like the Nat Geo channel? Anybody? Anybody want to admit that? I love it. I grew up as a kid watching programs like Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom on Sunday afternoons, waiting for the Disney Channel. I still enjoy watching nature programs like that. And it may sound somewhat gory, but what I find really interesting is when they show footage of big cats, like lions or tigers or jaguars, hunting. These cats have an uncanny way of isolating a member of a herd, either of antelope or water buffalo, whatever their prey preference for that day is. And once isolated, what do? They attack. Isolation, by definition, is not safe. To that end, let me say this very plainly, some of us have done half the enemy's work for him by isolating ourselves. That resonate with anybody? We have an enemy who wants to kill, steal, and destroy, and his tactics largely revolve around isolating us from one another. And some of us have done half his work by isolating ourselves from other people. And the reason that we do this is because we're full of pride. Pride that we're strong, that we can make it on our own, that we don't need anybody, that we can do this thing ourselves. And it's all lies born out of fear and pride. We can't do it on our own. So in our desire to be safe, we make decisions that actually make us less safe. And those of you who are prepared to be honest could likely tell a story or two attesting to the fact that some of the most harmful and destructive decisions you've made in life, you've made in isolation. Some of the most hurtful decisions we've made in our lives, we've made when we were on our own. So when safety becomes ultimate, not only do we isolate ourselves, we also hide. We hide. Because if someone sees us for who we really are or finds out what we've really done, they'll walk out, they'll run away, they'll abandon us. They might see that we're vulnerable and they'll attack us. And that is why some of us have become very proficient at hiding, even in big crowds. It's easy to hide when the numbers are large. So let me ask you this. When someone opens up to you in a real, authentic way, they in genuine fashion disclose something personal, they trust you with some information, are you drawn to them or are you repelled by them? Most of us, I think, would say that we are drawn to that person, that we feel closer to them. Openness invites openness. Transparency invites transparency. Now, I know that some of you have an objection to this. You're like, listen, George, there are people out there that when they see someone become vulnerable, they attack, they pounce. And you're right, there are people like that out there. They're called wolves. And they're certainly not friend material. And the reason certain people attack when others are vulnerable is usually because those people themselves have been so deeply wounded along the way, they follow the old adage, hurt people hurt people. For most of us, most of the time, experiencing someone become vulnerable, it draws us to them. This is a lengthy explanation to simply say this. We need one another. If we would simply own up to this fact and would embrace the risk and become vulnerable with one another, stop isolating ourselves and hiding from one another, but rather develop true friendships, we would actually get what we're ultimately longing for, and that is safety. Which is why one guy talking about relationships said, you either get all of me or you get none of me. I'm not pretending anymore. That's a really good way to live. King Solomon said it this way. You may have heard these verses quoted at a wedding, and though it's not about marriage per se, it does speak to the power of friendship on the most fundamental level. It says here, two people are better than one, for they can help each other succeed. If one person falls, the other can reach out and help him. But someone who falls alone is in real trouble. Likewise, two people lying close together can keep each other warm. But how can one be warm alone? A person standing alone can be attacked and defeated, but two can stand back to back and conquer. Three are even better, for a triple-crated cord is not easily broken. The last verse, by the way, is why this verse is often quoted at weddings. And it does apply to marriage. It's the cord of three strands. When a man and a woman in the context of a covenant bond and marriage genuinely weave Jesus into their relationships as that third strand, their bond becomes exponentially stronger. And the same thing is true for our friendships. So let me ask you this as we begin to wrap up here. If a person's wealth is measured by the depth of his or her friendships, are you wealthy or are you poor? Do you live in plenty or do you live in poverty? I consider myself to be very blessed when it comes to the breadth and depth of the relationships that I have in my life. But it wasn't always that way. When Shauna and I moved out here to Edmonton some 22 years ago, we could count the people we knew in the city on one hand. We had a decision to make. Would we do life in isolation, or would we begin to slowly forge some deep friendships? Since doing life alone is a really crappy and lonely way to live, not to mention it misses out on one of God's purposes for our lives, we decided that we would slowly make some friends. And we've learned over the years the value of living in ever-deepening relationships. And this church has been one of the key teachers and sources of that in our lives as we've seen and entered into growing friendships. So I'm very grateful for the friendships I've been able to be a part of and do consider myself to have a wealth of great friends. And what I want to do now is I want to paint a picture, and I just want you to indulge me. I've told the kids ministry we're going to go a little bit longer today, but just hang in there with me because I want to paint a picture for you of what I have in my life. If our lives are like a table and the ones that we've invited to sit at our table are our friends, here are a few of my close friends. So I'm going to invite them to come up, and I appreciate their willingness to do this. I've invited a few close friends of mine to come up and sit at my table. Now, these are not all my friends. If space and time would have allowed it, I would have invited several more friends to sit around this table. I would have invited guys like Jim and Stan and Dietmar and Gary and Mike to join these guys up here. I'm blessed with great friends. But just allow me to introduce a few of my good friends. We'll work from your left to the right. Glenn here is one of the most gifted friends that I have. He's a mechanical engineer who, unlike some of his engineer associates, they think they're all that in a bag of chips when they put that iron ring on their finger. He's probably the most gifted and humble, hardworking, and dedicated guy that I know. He's an example for me, and he's probably hardworking to a fault. Glenn has enriched my journey in that we meet for lunch regularly. We talk about our marriages. We talk about our children. We talk about our work. We talk about the challenges we face on all those fronts. And he's willing, like the rest of these guys, to ask me the tough questions as he himself is vulnerable with me. Next is Wes. He's a father of four lovely girls, and I'm grateful for his good work on that as he increases the odds that my boy will marry well. Two down from Wes is Eric, and he's also got four girls, so I'm eternally grateful for the both of them. Thank you. But one of the things I do and love and appreciate most about Wes is that he is a loving husband and he is a great father. His girls might not know it, but he is setting for his daughters an incredibly high standard of who the guys they ultimately choose should be like. He loves his girls well. His heart for people is huge. He's one of the best servants that I know. He's dedicated, he's committed, and he's a faithful friend. And I know if something ever hits the fan in my life at like 2 a.m., I know Wes would meet me anywhere and he'd bring me a cup of coffee. Wes is a good friend. Then there's Henry. Henry is one of the most recent additions to my band of brothers. I consider him, along with guys like Jim and Stan and Dietmar, some of the more seasoned friends that I have, if you know what I mean. Henry looks really young. He actually is. But I have some seasoned friends in my life who are gifts to me. Henry's quiet, thoughtful, and reflective demeanor is only matched by his wisdom, his discernment, and his kindness. If I need advice on anything, particularly on work-related concerns, Henry is one of my go-to guys. The times that we have coffee together are so encouraging and so life-giving. He models for me what it means to live with integrity. When I grow up, I want to be like Henry. I mean that seriously. Then there's Eric. Eric and I first met at Costco. The man was trying to get my attention by throwing nickels at my head. He's nuts. And it's probably very good that Eric and I didn't meet until we were both people of faith and had children. I think he and I would either have died base jumping, really, or we'd be in prison together today. I guarantee you that. One of the things I appreciate about Eric is his passion for life. He lives with an intensity that is unbelievable. He sees life as a gift and he goes after it. And what I also appreciate about Eric is that we've been able to be there for each other in life's most darkest moments. I remember after his fourth daughter was born and things were not going well for Linnell, she was hemorrhaging badly. I'm sitting there in the room staring at a man who's got four girls, one less than a few hours old, and he had the prospect of losing his wife. When you go through stuff like that together, it cements something. And Eric's been there for me in my dark times. There have been a number of times I was ready to stop, to quit what I'm doing, to pack it in. And we've had a couple of conversations in his pickup truck where he asked me some tough questions. And he's one of the reasons why I keep on keeping on. Then there's Ken. Ken is also an engineer. By the way, most of these guys up here, they're either engineers or numbers guys. And they're almost all foodies, which is perfect for me because my favorite question every day is, how many more times do I get to eat today? So he's a gifted electrical engineer, probably one of the best project managers this province has. Ken and I have run 6 marathons together. We've prepared for 6 marathons together. We have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of kilometers in our past. And when you're out on the road for that long, you talk about stuff. The other thing is, we both have wives who are very quiet. And I mean this in like the best way, okay? Our girls don't say much, but when they say something, it's heavy. Both of our wives are also really good with guns. They are. They're both marksmen. They're great shots. And so Ken and I kind of feel it's best to behave and share our heart with one another. So we run. We always go home, by the way, but we run. Ken has been also there for me in some very tough times in my life. He has wisdom beyond his years. He is not afraid to be vulnerable. He does not hide. He's willing to answer some of the tough questions as he's willing to ask me some of the tough questions. Ken is a great friend. And then there's Tom. Tom and I have been friends since our boys were in preschool together. We've also run several marathons together, and we've talked about a lot of stuff. Nobody listens as well as Tom does. He has the hugest heart. He's a man of great compassion and great kindness. Our families regularly go on holidays together, and it is great fun. One of my best memories is we went to Florida once, and on a Saturday morning we ran a half marathon, and on the Sunday morning we ran a full marathon. And he went to the parks that afternoon as if nothing happened. I was in a wheelchair. The other thing I love about Tom is that Tom has seen incredible pain in his life. And he's one of the realest guys that I know. And when you walk with someone who's seen more pain than you can ever imagine, there's a reality in your relationship that you cherish. He's got a huge heart. He has a servant heart. Just last Saturday, our wives and us, we were going to go out together for dinner. He calls me up in the afternoon and he says, "Hey, you've got a fireplace. You need some firewood?" I said, "Sure." he shows up 15 minutes early, pickup truck full of firewood, dressed up really nicely, and he starts stacking wood with me. This is what Tom does. This is the kind of friend that he is. He doesn't think of himself. He thinks of other people. One of the things that I've said that we're looking for in life is safety. But there's a problem that occurs when we go in search of safety. Oh, I'm in trouble with the kids. Just hang in there. When we make it an ultimate thing in our life, we end up doing some things that are very counterproductive. And what I'd like to do now, very briefly, is invite these men to join me up here, over here, and I want to have all of you answer some questions. So guys, come around and face out. So does this look safe to you? Seriously, does this look safe to you? Yeah. See, there are wolves out there, and they want nothing more than to take me down. But I can tell you this, they're going to have to go through these men first. All right, turn in. Does this look safe to you? See, one of the things that we try to do is we try to hide. We try to walk away. We try to be all by, on our own. But these men have a front view of my life. They look into my life. They see me. And we think that running away is safe, but seeing in is safe. These guys know me. They see what's going on in my life. They ask me the tough questions. This is safe. Let me show you one more thing. Does this look safe to you? Yeah, this is safe. Anybody want to come and take me on? No. Seriously, you want to come? You want to have a go? Any takers? Here's one thing that I know. If by some miraculous happening you actually got to me, these men would pick me right back up. And then they would find you. This is safe. But here's the thing. It wasn't always this way. I didn't always have Glenn in my life. There wasn't always a Tom. There wasn't always a Wes. There wasn't always a Ken. There wasn't always a Henry. And there wasn't always Eric. Anybody want to take me on now? Now you can. Now you can take me down. It's not safe to be alone. What we do so often is we do half the enemy's work for him by isolating ourselves, and we go into hiding. I'm not sure how many of you know the band The Eagles, but there's a great song entitled Desperado, and there's one line that says, "Your prison is walking through this world all alone." Moving from a place of loneliness or having no friends to a place where you're cultivating deep relationships doesn't happen overnight. You didn't get to where you are overnight. You're not going to get out of where you are overnight. Deep friendships don't happen by accident. It has to be intentional. So here's the last questions, and we're done with this. As we put our friendships under review, there are some potential takeaways for today. So let me ask you this. Who's at your table? What are their motivations for being at your table? Are the people who are at your table there for the right reasons? Are they wise or unwise? Who shouldn't be at the table? I mean, you can have friends that don't get to influence your decision-making. Who actually should be at the table? Who's not there? Who needs a voice? Have you given them permission to speak into your life? Are you being forthright and honest with them? Are you putting yourself in environments where you might bump into people who can have a seat at your table? I mean, are you hanging out in places where wise people hang out? Think about that. It's your table. God has empowered you to choose who sits at your table. You were not meant to go through life alone. Jesus, the Son of God, during his lifetime here, his 33 years or so, he chose to do life together with 12 other men. Of those, he had three he was particularly close to, and of those three, he had one. Here's the reality about some of us. Some of us think we're stronger than Jesus. The Savior of this world developed deep relationships. A lot of us think we don't need what he had. The reason any of us can have the kind of friends that we're talking about today is because Jesus has been that kind of friend to us. Here's the way Jesus put it, and that's it. My command is this: love each other as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, than to lay down his life for one's friends. You are my friends if you do what I command. I no longer call you servants because a servant does not know his master's business. Instead, I have called you friends. For everything that I learned from my Father, I have made known to you. You did not choose me, but I chose you and appointed you so that you might go and bear fruit, fruit that will last, and so that whatever you ask in my name, the Father will give you. This is my command. Love each other. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we're so grateful that you've created us for friendships, deep friendships based on who you are. We thank you for the gifts of those people who are friends in our life. And for those of us who don't have the kind of friendships that we really want to have, we just pray that you would encourage us, help us to learn to risk and to trust and to develop the kind of friendships that are based on you. We thank you, Father, that we do not need to walk through life alone. We thank you that you are there, that you empower us by your Spirit, that you walk with us, that you nurture us. We just pray that you would give us strength to build the kind of relationships that ultimately bring honor to you. And Father, we're so very glad that we can also continue to worship you by giving back to you. As we now give back a portion of our income to you, we acknowledge that we are stewards of what's been entrusted to us. It's really all yours. You're so generous to us. And by giving a portion back to you, we just want to tell you we love you. We're invested in your kingdom work, and we appreciate what you're doing in this world and are so glad that we can be a part of it. We want to bless you by giving back to you now. Amen.